today, as we were saying, the head of our week got cut off from yesterday's snow delay. We're still feeling the snow impact a little bit. So our Sigresha schedule is a little bit upended. So here's a story. Yesterday, being Sunday, so our agenda was to talk about the halakha ma'aseh ramifications of halakha shenitzvuka l'gufa tibbutz. So it's still our intent to do that today. We'll do that a slight delay. And then we have about one day left of the longest of the sugya, which will presumably be tomorrow. The question is then, so after that, so our plan is to go into Pesach Reisha, which, starting in a week when the head was cut off, it means one day on Wednesday. So I'll give you the option, you tell me later what you think is a better idea. We can start it on Wednesday, or, I guess the speaker has a feeling on the matter, or we also probably need to spend the day on the coast with Zomer, Zomer B'tzarech Le'etzim, which also kind of segues into the Kotzer. So we could do that on Wednesday, and then just have a clean week for Pesach Reisha. Or we could start Pesach Reisha on Wednesday. I don't know if anybody has a feeling about that one way or another. We'll decide later, but feel free to weigh in for the heads of the feelings. It's a prisoner locked in this Anybody speak Morse code? Okay, let's try to get some of the halakha ma'aseh implications down. So essentially, this sugya, as you know, impacts a lot of Hilcha Shabbos. And just as the sugya itself is confusing, trying to nail down a halakhic conclusion is confusing. Why shouldn't it be consistent with the whole trend of the sugya throughout? We'll try to talk about it broadly first. Then there are specific halakhas and specific malachos which have prominent implications. If we have time, we'll talk about some of them today. If not, we may push off those details to the specific halakhas in which they come up. But first, we'll try to speak more broadly. So first of all, in terms of the question of what is a halakha shenitzvicha l'gufa, how do we define it? So very, very broadly, kind of gliding over all the discussion that we had last week, well, we know broadly there is the view of Tosis that halacha shenitzvicha l'gufa means a halacha being done for a purpose other than why it was done in the Mishkan. And we have the view of the other Rishonim, which seem to be some different formulation, seem to broadly go into the category of a halacha that you don't want to do, a halacha to get rid of something, a halacha to address a problem, different versions of that separate from the Tosis. Mishkanian view. So who wins the halacha, which is adopted as practical halacha? So of course, it's not so clear. The Magen Avraham, in his comments, tends to work off a Tosfos position, that it's about the Mishkan. While the Taz seems to take a other Rishonim type of view. You just know, in terms of setting halakha ma'aseh, at least for the next generation, it's probably relevant. So last night, I was learning with my children the 39 halakha book by Baruch Chait. So in that book, he takes Tosfos' view. So you should just know that our children are being educated in Tosfos' view, so we'll see what effect that has in coming generations. But the 39 halakha book, he defines a halakha shenitzvicha l'gufa as a halakha not done for the Mishkan's perspective, apparently siding with the Magen Avraham. I mentioned when we started this sugya that even though it's a minority view in Rishonim, it seems to be a majority view in terms of what people of Zman HaZeh think of in terms of halakha shenitzvicha l'gufa. So perhaps the book has a big role in terms of forming that mentality. So the Magen Avraham and the 39 halachos perhaps in that direction, and the Taz seemingly following the other Rishonim. The Sefer Nesivos Shalom, which we mentioned last week, so he assumes that therefore the halacha we should probably be machmir for both. So what does that mean to be machmir for both? So presumably it means that in order to be able and to say something is a halacha shenitzvicha l'gufa, it would probably have to fit neither definition. It would need neither be productive or for the purposes of the Mishkan. One could throw out a consideration, which I'll just leave you to think about, in terms of analyzing that question, should you be machmir for both definitions? How exactly does one approach this question in the halacha? So in terms of Lumbus, of the whole issue, so we saw that Rashi had his perspective, which sounds like Rashi was saying that it's about getting rid of a problem, situation that you don't want, you're getting rid of it. And Tosfos takes big issue with Rashi, and Tosfos brings a number of examples which don't really fit that model. He takes a different position. So we spent some time talking about whether Rashi is being interpreted correctly. And for example, Rav Asher Weiss, we did mention this in the comment, Rav Asher Weiss attacks Tosfos, basically because Tosfos seems to be assuming that Rashi only has one definition of Malach HaShem Shekhulu. And as was raised here last week, maybe there's more than one definition. Maybe Rashi in some places is saying this is Malach HaShem Shekhulu, and other places he's giving you another example of Malach HaShem Shekhulu. And Tosfos seems to be assuming that there has to be one working definition, and since Rashi, according to him, doesn't seem to fit the bill, that's a big problem with Rashi. So that seems to prompt a different question. What is Malach HaShem Shekhulu Gufo? Is it a positive definition or is it a negative definition? Essentially, is it that a malacha, in order to be chayiv, has to be Tzricha L'Gufa, which presumably has one definition? Or is it that you're pater on a malacha if it has the problem of being Eina Tzricha L'Gufa? And then maybe Eina Tzricha L'Gufa could be a couple of different versions of Eina Tzricha L'Gufa. So in terms of trying to nail down this question, if you were a posek, you might be asking that question. You might be saying, what is the tour, what is the nature of saying Malach HaShem Shekhulu Gufa is not chayiv? Is it a positive definition? And then perhaps it's my job to find one definition. Or is it a negative definition, that is a flaw, which could perhaps be a number of different flaws, and then maybe a number of things might fit l'kula into the picture. So that's just an abstract consideration, which may be part of the story. If you ever want to paskin on this issue, then maybe throw it to the analytical considerations. So if we assume, whatever it is, that once we define what a Malach HaShem Shekhulu Gufa is, so are we chayav or are we patur from Malach HaShem Shekhulu Gufa? And so it's machlokas in the Gemara. So we have Reb Shimon saying that we're patur, and Rabbi Yochanan saying, Rabbi Huda saying that you are chayiv. So how do we pasuk? So of course the question is, who are we? Right. So we know that the Rambam paskins like Rabbi Huda, as does the Rif. The Magid Mishnah quotes the Rif as agreeing with him.
Is that the halachos in the Magid Mishnah?
Sorry.
Because the Magid Mishnah only says the halachos. Is that always the Rif?
Oh yeah, the Rif is halachos, right? The Rif is known as the So that's basically the position of those Rishonim. And others, we assume that most others seem to agree with Rav Shimon that one is Pater. I mean, here in a couple of places talks about being a big machlokas on Rishonim, and it seems to be that his Nitiya is like Rav Shimon that one is Pater. Tosfos takes this view, and then we get to the Shulchan Aruch. So Shulchan Aruch is somewhat of an ambiguity as well, again. The rule in the sugya, every step along the way, you have to have some heavy degree of ambiguity. So Shulchan Aruch in two places, in Shin Tes Zayin, Tes, and in Shin Lamed Daled, Chav Zayin, quotes both views. Yes, and Shin Lamed Daled, Chav Zayin.
She quotes,
sorry?
Shin Lamed Daled.
Chav Zayin.
He's just referencing those.
So that's the question, what does he do? So he quotes the view, first he says the view that it's Pater, and then he quotes the Rambam. So Tobia says he's just referencing. So that's possible. That's the Dvar Yeshua, a number of truths about this, we'll talk about it in a minute. Yeshua Ehrenberg of Tel Aviv, so he assumes that the Shulchan Aruch is clearly paskening Pater like Rav Shimon. And he quotes from the Chalkas Machoke, and from a few others, he quotes from the Shach. As a general rule, in terms of reading the Shulchan Aruch, that if the Shulchan Aruch says a view, and then he throws in another view, that's just Derech Eretz, the other view that he really agrees with the first. In general, how to read the Shulchan Aruch when he quotes different opinions and how he makes it, is lengthy literature, but this is the view that some take of the Shulchan Aruch, that he's really siding with Reb Shimon, and he's mentioning the Rambam, and the Rambam, but he's not passing like the Rambam. There is a whole literature in another comment in the Shulchan Aruch in Shin Mem, where he talks about one of the other issues, which is a major sugya within a certain malacha. So we probably won't get to it today, and we'll probably push it off for that actual malacha. But the question of shaving and cutting nails, when we get into gozes, we'll talk about the specifics, because there's a lot of detail about how exactly that's affected by malacha shinshu gufa. So we discussed that was somewhat of a machlokus rishonim, whether or not cutting nails or cutting hair is itself considered to be a malacha hatzricha l'gufa. That if one works off of the Mishnayian view, probably it's a malacha shinshu gufa, although there's one to quibble on also. But the intuitive impression is that in the Mishnah they cut off the hair of a sheep in order to use it, and cutting it off to get rid of it could be seen as a malacha shinshu gufa. And that's somewhat of a debate. Right, the Mishnah quotes a view that one is chayy for this, and Tosfos says, well, that's only according to Yehuda, and it's a whole discussion of the Rishon. So the Shulchan Aruch quotes the view that one is chayy, prompting, again, a whole discussion. And the Vilna Gaon to comment over there that the Shulchan Aruch pasuk is like Rabbi Yehuda. And the Bir Halacha to also take a view in that direction. But there's a way out of it, as some of the later scholars say, if you look and see if it covers some halachas, he has a discussion about this, that it's easy to reconcile, if one wants to reconcile that comment with the assumption that the Shulchan Aruch passing is like Reb Shimon, because one could say that that case is simply defined in accordance with those who hold it's a malacha tzricha l'gufa. So some ambiguity about the view of the Shulchan Aruch, but it's often assumed that general halacha l'maisa is malacha shetzricha l'gufa pater, and that's the way the Pichadash writes. He thinks all the Achronim, he says, have argued on the Rambam, and that this is the general view. If you look in the Pichadash in general, the Pichadash in his commentary is very good at going through everybody who came before him and saying, this is what I think the conclusion is. So this is how he assumes in this case that malacha shetzricha l'gufa, we follow the view of Reb Shimon and Reb Pater. Okay, so far we've seen now two stages of ambiguity, right? What does malacha shetzricha l'gufa mean? And if we can decide what it means, then what is our view? Is it actually chayiv, or can we assume, like Reb Shimon, that it's pater? So let's assume, for argument's sake, that despite all of the back and forth about what the Shulchan Aruch is saying, that yes, this is the case that we, in quotations, say malacha shetzricha l'gufa is pater. Now we have another level of ambiguity to figure out. What does that mean? What exactly is the scope of being pater? So it's pater and it's gesundheit, whatever you want. It's pater and it's nisr derabanan. So here again, we have quite a bit of ambiguity. There is actually a view of Pnei Yeshua and Shabbos, Adaf and Vavim and Beis, quotes a suggestion that he made, that he thinks that actually it's an Isser D'Oraisa. That when we say, Lach Shemesh Rizu is Pater, we only meant to say that it is Pater from Onish. But it's still an Isser D'Oraisa because it's still a violation, as he puts it, of Lo Sasim Kom Lach. So you're still doing a Malacha. It's an issue of Malachas Machsheves. Malachas Machsheves is derived from its Smichas HaParshis in the Mishkan and Shabbos, specifically in the context of the Onesh of Shabbos. So it's derived as a Ptur Onesh, says the Pnei Yeshua. But still an Isser D'Oraisa, still an Isser Lav. This is not the generally accepted perception of Malach Shin Shri L'Gufa. It's generally assumed that it is an Isser D'Rabbanan.
So are you suggesting that there's a separation between the Malachos of Lo Tasuka Malacha and the Malachos of Malachos Machshevet?
Yes, which is a pretty significant
statement. So every Kilgo or situation...
Yeah, how far would you want to go about that? It's a good question. It may be that you would... It's not that long of a comment, but you wouldn't treat everything in full detail. And it could be another place that's even more
said.
It's also not really 100% clear from the way he phrases it whether he's really sure about himself. He said, like, I suggested this in my youth. I mean, he runs with it a little bit, so...
Where's he quoting?
Man out in the base. So how far he goes with it is somewhat open to discussion. And again, I don't think this reflects the generally perceived notion that Moshe Yeshua Lagufa, although it's a good introduction to the perception because it is perceived as more chomer than your general Darabonis. That it is taken as somewhat more severe, prompting some discussion. Do we almost, for most intents and purposes, treat it like a Daraisa? Meiri emphasizes that there is a Tzad Daraisa, there is an aspect of a Daraisa involved. And the Ran in his commentary to the Rif, and Daf Samach Aleph and Aleph, Daf Bei HaRif. So the Ran over there, at least in one approach he has to the Gemara, and you could also question whether it's his conclusion also, but the Ran suggests that with Malach Hashem Yitzricha Lagufa, even though he clearly assumes it's the Rabbanan, but he says we would not be makel, he's talking there about putting out a fire, that we would not be makel b'makom seda, just because there's a great loss involved, which we often would do for a normal Rabbanan, or for Amir al-Akr. Because again, he's assuming that, he explains the first one by saying, he says, because it's too hard to figure out whether or not something really is Torah Kalufu or not. So therefore, the line between Daraisa and Rabbanan is just too blurry. And then when he talks about the Amir al-Akr, he says, we're afraid you're going to come to do it yourself, because this is talking about he's still in the context there of property burning down. Says, a person is going to be so worked up about his property loss that he's likely to come to do it himself. So one could praise the schumer in a number of ways. Right? One could say that you could go the whole Pnei Hoshua direction and say it's essentially a Daraisa. Or you could say that this is so close to a Daraisa, even just in concept, because it's the same action that is a Daraisa, and just change your intent and it becomes a Daraisa. Or the Ran's formulation seems a little bit different, but he's saying that it's something we have to be very machmir on for practical reasons, that the closeness to a Daraisa is so prominent that therefore that's a reason to be machmir, not necessarily saying there's conceptually different, but that it's practically so close that we have to be machmir for that reason. So that gives us a number of different formulations why one would be machmir. Or one could also be laughing because maybe he's choshesh to the view of the Rambam. Right? But the fact that the Ari Shon hold it is a Daraisa. So an attitude of Chumra to Malach Hashem Yitzricha Lagufa can come from a number of different gradations. Right? Either maybe you think the whole thing is chayiv, or you think it's pater but it's a Daraisa, or you think that it's pater and a Drabana, but it's a Drabana that's conceptually close to a Daraisa. Or because it's Pater and Rabbanan, but dangerously close to a Daraisa in terms of practice, all reasons that have been invoked to perhaps be more machmir when it comes to a Malach Hashem Yitzricha Lagufa. Nonetheless, we find different union, both the Kula and the Chumra. The Magen Avraham is quoted as saying that the Mokum Tsar were Mako. Say quoted as saying, he doesn't exactly say that. The later story, they bring down that's the view of the Magen Avraham, that we allow Malach Hashem Yitzricha Lagufa and Makom Tzar. What he really says is, and the case is a detailed one, we're going to leave it for the last few minutes in case we have time, because it gets into more detail, but commenting on a certain scenario where the Shulchan Aruch says you're allowed to resolve Tzar and to do something. So the Magen Avraham says, like Makas Mursa. So is that a way of saying that that's a Malach Hashem Yitzricha Lagufa model, and therefore that's Mutter from Makom Tzar? So again, he's quoted that way, and if you look in the Makas HaShekel on the bottom of the page, so he has a whole back and forth that maybe the Magen Avraham could apply even according to Rabbi Yehuda, but the Makas Mursa, the whole discussion. But again, later Svarim have read the Magen Avraham to be saying that we allow a Malach Hashem Yitzricha Lagufa Makom Tzar, even though the language is a little bit more ambiguous than that, and open to a little bit more discussion. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in his Tshuva Sneinu Shlomo, so he takes the view that there is a great chumrah towards Lakshin Shrich Lagufa. And therefore, another example of a kula that would not apply is Bein Hashmashos. We normally say, the Gemara says that Ein Shvus Bein Hashmashos, that during the time when it's not fully Shabbos yet, we don't have the Surah Rabbanan that are categorized as a Shvus. So he assumes this is not the case for a Lakshin Shrich Lagufa. On the other hand, the Dvar Yeshua, who we mentioned before, Varenberg, so he takes the approach in his Truvas in general that sees it as closer to a basic Rabbanan. So, for example, he writes that in the situation of Kavod Abrios, which is a sugya in Shabbos, in the territory that we're likely to cover, so as you should hope to get more into the whole sugya of Kavod Abrios in general, but he does assume that since the Gemara says that we can allow an Isser Rabbanan to be performed to protect human dignity in Kavod Abrios, so Malach Hashem Tzvichu Lufa is in that category. And he also says that this would be subject to the rule of Yitiru Sofa and Mishum Chilasa. That we have the situations, for those of you familiar, there's a big debate about this between Moshe Feinstein and Shlomo Zalman Aravah. Sofa and Mishum Chilasa, I'll explain what it means. But in terms of how this concept is applied, it's for a different time. Hopefully we'll get to it in a different context. But it's a fascinating display of how contemporary Gedolim can argue with each other about the language that Rav Shlomo Zalman uses to express his extremely respectful disagreement with Moshe Feinstein. It's really an education to read on the subject. But again, not getting into it, but it has to do with the basic question of things that are permitted because of Pikuach Nefesh. So to when do we also not only allow you to do them, but to come back from them? Now, the question of a doctor who's allowed to go to the hospital because he's called to serve a patient. So to what extent do we let him come back also? The story being that if we don't allow him to come back, so the next time he's going to say, well, listen, it was I got a call Friday night, I had to spend a whole Shabbos in the hospital, so next time I get a call, I'm not going to go. So to what extent do we factor that in and call that a pikuach nefesh consideration also? It's a big discussion, halacha mais, again, for a different time. But let's assume that there's greater latitude for the rabbanans in this area. So does that latitude extend to malach Hashem Tzvichu L'gufa? So the Dvar Yeshua assumes that it does. In the context he's talking about somebody has to drive somebody to the hospital on Shabbos. And then the question is he allowed to then turn off the engine once he gets to the hospital? So should we assume that if he doesn't turn off the engine, he's assuming turning off the engine is an act of kibui? But it's kibui shlo tzricha l'gufa, because you're just interested in protecting the car by turning it off. So is that something that we can allow with the svar that if we don't let the person turn his car off, next time he's not going to want to drive somebody to the hospital because of the consequences for his car afterwards? So should we say, Yitiru Sofa Mishum Tchilasa Neh, should we say that Malach Hashem Tzrich L'gufa is subject to that kind of attitude? And his perspective is, yes, it's treated like a Rabbanan, and therefore his Yitiru was to be Mekel, in this case, based on that svar. Okay, so that's a whole other level, right? So far,
onto the section of
the Moshe last, the Moshe discussion about something else, which is about the racism, about the Moshe was more makeable than that's a discussion we'll leave for a different time. Just kind of a preview that that's all an issue. The question of what are you allowed to do after a Pikuach Nefesh situation, based on the Sigma Gemara, which talks about it, which they were commenting on, which we'll leave for a different time. In terms of our narrow Malach Hashem Tzrich L'gufa focus, so can that be viewed leniently in this context? Dvar Yeshua thought, yes.
Hi. So we're recording for the Kavod Abrios?
Also the Dvar Yeshua. So that's again another stage of discussion. So what have we seen so far? Right, the question of what is a Malach Hashem Tzrich L'gufa? The question of how do we paskin on the whole issue of Malach Hashem Tzrich L'gufa Chayav Pater? And then if we assume that we know what it is and that's Pater, what does it mean to be Pater? How do we view that? Do we view that like an Issur D'Rabbanan, and do the kulas of Issur D'Rabbanan apply? Now, there is a whole other arena of discussion, a fascinating arena, which is somewhat controversial. Can we perhaps define a whole other aspect of Lakshmi and Tzrit Lagufa, and we touched upon this a little bit Thursday during the Chumash Shiv, as we were here. Is there perhaps a whole other avenue here? The Maharik has a tshuva. I don't remember whether it was on the Ramakumas or not. I think it was. But the Maharik has a tshuva where he talks about the Gemara at the end of Yevamos. Where the Gemara talks about a non-Jew who threatens a Jew and do a malacha for me on Shabbos, or I'll kill you like I killed somebody else. Where again, this is our Yevamos Shabbos Achdus moment once again. This is the end of Yevamos, the other end. So the Gemara has a discussion. Somebody is told to do an act, do a malacha, do a bishul, do a kotzer on behalf of somebody who is threatening to kill him. Otherwise, there'll be dire consequences. So the Maharik has a perspective in that tshuva that, besides the pikuach nefesh considerations, this act by its very nature becomes the malacha shein tzrichu lagufa. Because the person doing this is only doing it essentially for a negative reason. Because he is looking to save his life. He's looking to eliminate the threat that somebody else is placing upon him, and therefore is called Malach Hashem Tzricha L'Gufa. Hi.
Luke is also referred to Tosos.
It's theoretically, if you accept the premise, which we'll see is a little controversial, it could work for either of you.
I mean, because according to Tosos, you're for sure not doing it.
Yeah, it doesn't take aside from the Rishonim. As far as the Rishonim are concerned, those who argue on it go through the Rishonim. We'll talk about this a little bit, but according to either view in the Rishonim, you could theoretically still say this big finish. You could say that we look at the fact that you're being threatened and we take that into consideration. So if we accept this premise, and we'll see that it was utilized by Postkin in a lot of different contexts, so then we've kind of opened up a whole new avenue here in the discussion of Keturah on Shabbos. That we basically said, so for example, last week we tried to figure out a little bit the difference between Davar Shein HaMeskaven and Malach Hashem Tzrichu L'Gufa. So let's say we'll call Davar Shein HaMeskaven intent and Malach Hashem Tzrichu L'Gufa purpose. Right? Intent, you know you're doing it because you want to do it, and purpose is why you're doing it. Here we'll have to now subdivide purpose into purpose and motivation. That even though when you're cooking for the purpose of cooking, but your motive to cook is the fact that the guy has a gun to your head. So presumably, to use English words, this is probably the best way to say it, that between Psik Resha, Lakshmi Tzrichu L'Gufa, as we've discussed so far, and this new category, this new subset of Lakshmi Tzrichu L'Gufa, the question is, what is our intent, what is our purpose, and what is our motivation? Don, you're up first.
Why is this any different than the case that Tosus uses to attack Rashi and all the other Rishonim about the clothing that has a hole in it, you're sewing it up?
Right.
It's the same exact thing. You don't want to be in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to have to do this cooking for the non-Jew, but it happens to me. He put a gun to my head and said, cook. So I'm cooking with shame cooking.
Right. So that if you accept that, I mean, you could perhaps be Mechalik, but there are a number of Achronim who didn't accept this, so we'll discuss it a little bit. Possibly because they understood it similar to the way you're phrasing it. So let's see how it's been discussed, and you'll tell me if you throw us a little question. Hi.
Why do you have to add motive? Isn't the purpose, meaning here the purpose is to save your life, not to do the law?
Right.
It happens to me that somebody's putting a gun to the head.
So why are you subdividing between
them? Yeah,
the reason I'm subdividing is to help explain why not everyone accepts it. If you agree with Yosef, so then presumably you don't see much of a difference between motivation. The Maharik's perspective apparently is that motivation and purpose are essentially the same. Right? So since your motivation is not to get shot, so therefore that's the purpose of the malacha, and you're part of that reason. Hi.
I think also to answer Dan's question, you could be machalic between different malachos.
Okay.
Choose a pile of fuel. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to say that your intention and your motivation to plow the field to save your life is not the same as making sure that your field has the correct furrows and to plant with. But for cooking or whatever, you know, you're cooking, he wants you to cook food, you need the food to be cooked. Similar to the case with your shirt, if it's ripped, you want it to be filled in. You want, in the end, there's that intermediate stage where, although it's ripped, I want it to be, you know, completed.
So tell me if I understand you correctly. Well, if I do understand, I'm not sure if the chiluk will support all the sources, but it could be a viable field anyway, that, you know, sometimes you have slave labor, so all the slave cares about is that he looks like he's working. He's not focused at all on the purpose of what he's doing, because he's going to get whipped if he doesn't look busy, so he's going to make sure to look busy. So essentially, the malacha, he may be committing actual malachas while he's doing this, but he's not focused at all on what he's accomplishing. He's focused on looking busy so he doesn't get whipped. So that, maybe you would call malacha shvichul gufa, while if he's actually purposeful, even though he's purposeful by being motivated by somebody who put on to his head, then maybe. So I think that's an interesting chiluk.
More extremely, yeah.
Right, I think it's an interesting chiluk. I don't know if it's supported by any of the discussions that actually are there, but it's a viable point. Hi.
What about the fact that the guy could actually benefit from the malacha? Like, he can have the soup when he's done.
Right, but he can, but he doesn't necessarily want to. You could say that by a lot of things. And a lot of malacha shvichul gufa, you could theoretically benefit. The question is, if that's not why he's doing it, then maybe it's patur anyway. So this is a that a lot of poskim did accept. Maybe taking Sammy's perspective, they do see it as essentially the same. So, for example, the Chafetz Chaim, who in these discussions is maybe more known for the Mishnah Berurah, but he also wrote a sefer called Machne Yisrael, where he talks about soldiers, and he says that the soldiers in Pshas Hetzak, when necessary, were forced in the army. He wrote the Sefer Machne Yisrael. It was written to the Jews who were conscripted into the Russian army and who were forced to do all kinds of activities by being in the Russian army. So the Chafetz Chaim notes there that there is a great Makom L'Hakel, that whatever malacha they're doing is not because they have any interest in doing the malacha, but because they are forced to by dint of their being the army in this context. And therefore, he thinks that that's something that can be acknowledged and worked with as well. There were poskim also discussion about this whole thing in the Shuvas Beis Yitzchak and Yitzchak Shmalkis. And there are those who also felt, in terms of, it comes up, anyone trying to go into medical school, so the very complicated residency Shabbos issues, the whole question of naniach that a doctor is allowed to perform malachos with sarach pikuach nefesh. But what happens if, by nature of the profession, he also is forced to do things which are not directly justified under a pikuach nefesh heading, which is most relevant during residency when a doctor is really in training and has very little say over what he's allowed, what his boss is going to let him do or not do in terms of functioning on Shabbos. And it creates tremendous shilas. This is not the context that they're going through it right now. But Shabbos and residency is a huge, huge, complicated area. So there were poskim, this is Eliezer's discussion that he also felt, that there was a tzad to call all the non-directly kuach nefesh malachas that a resident is forced to do, to see that as a malacha shein tzrich legufa, again, because he's being forced to do it by the circumstances of his employment, rather than because of his desire to do the malacha. The Chachma Shlomo, who in general has very creative halachic suggestions which are often not fully accepted. So one of those that was not fully accepted, the Chachma Shlomo says, not just doctors, but also any worker who's being paid by somebody to work. So perhaps one could take the perspective that therefore his motivation is getting paid. His motivation is not the malacha that he's doing, and that makes it a malacha shein tzrich legufa. Again, this is not taking as license to go to work on Shabbos. Why exactly not? We'll discuss a little bit more. Rav Nosson Gishtetner has a tshuva in which he takes issue with this, using a svara that we'll discuss in a few minutes. But that's another view. It's another utilization of this perspective. We had an interesting discussion about this on Thursday. We were talking about Parshas Noah. So we talked about the pasuk towards the end of the parasha after the flood, which Chazal interpret to be a mocker, that Shomer Shabbos is only for Jews, that the non-Jew is not supposed to be Shomer Shabbos technically. And we discussed the question of what does somebody do if he's kind of in an in-between position. So we discussed how there was a literature about this regarding the Avos, and that there's a whole question whether the Avos were Jewish or not, and that some of the literature seems to assume they were basically also briskers, and they were dealing with it as a suffix, kind of behoshish to the different views at the same time, trying to figure out how to both be Shomer Shabbos and not be Shomer Shabbos at the same time. We
discussed at that time my favorite joke, which is always worth repeating, because somebody I know did this in real life after having heard the joke. He was asked, he was at somebody's house on Shabbos, he's a potential ger, so he's not Jewish, and he was asked, the hosts who were hosting for Shabbos, they said, so what do you do about Shabbos? And technically, you should be Machal Shabbos, so the first of Shabbos. So he reaches into his pocket and pulls out his keys. And they said to him, but there's a neighbor here, can help. So he responds, I don't hold from the Arab. Which is a joke, but he did it in real life, having heard the joke. It's a great joke. But it also could be nogeya to this sugya specifically, because it's an interesting question. So whatever malacha this person does, so Donnie was bringing up on Thursday, that maybe it shouldn't help, because maybe it's a malacha shenishrikulagufa. If his motivation is davka to be machal Shabbos, so then maybe that's a problem. Maybe that's not going to be considered to be a full malacha for this purpose. So that's a good question. So afterwards, Sammy told me we were walking out that he had heard of such a situation where somebody discovered, already in the state of having lived life as a religious Jew, had discovered that he wasn't Jewish and was trying to figure out if this is correct. Can you tell me this?
Nice.
Oh, sorry, you brought up the question. Donnie was telling this afterwards. Sorry. Sammy brought up the question before, and then Donnie was telling the story. I reversed the names. So it sometimes happens. So Donnie was telling me a story about somebody who discovered he was Jewish. Definitely wasn't Jewish after having lived a Jewish life, so he was trying to figure out what to do, and that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky advised him to light a match on Shabbos in order to be Machal Shabbos while he was figuring it out. And he raised the objection, but shouldn't it be viewed as a malach shenitzvichu l'gufo? So that Rabbi Yaakov responded to him, for this you can rely on the Rambam. You can rely on the Rambam and say that it's echayet. So that touches upon Tuvia's question, you know, just how far do you have to go? If the idea is that you shouldn't be Shomer Shabbos, so do you have to be Machal Shabbos Kol HaDeis, or is it enough that you're making a statement, and that if there is a view in Rishonim, a view in the Gemara, that it's a full Shabbos, maybe that's enough, maybe that accomplishes the goal of not being a Goyish Shabbos. So that's a separate sugya. Again, how to figure out what exactly the requirements, because that's a very, very vague sugya to begin with, but maybe it can be a Malach Shin Shechul Guf, but maybe that should be enough.
I just do something that you get an off from, and therefore, by definition, it's Sriko Gufa. Like, if you toast a marshmallow.
Yeah, presumably he could have, right. If you don't have to accept the whole Yisrael anyway, right, presumably there are ways to get around it, but just as interesting for the purposes of our discussion to not uncomplicate it, to leave it complicated so we can try to figure it out. A lot of this draws from a comment of the Maharsha. The Maharsha, I think I did put on the Maharsha, the Maharsha in Bava Basra and put a few tests. So the Maharsha discusses the very difficult position of the Gemara, the Gemara and Shabbos as well, about the Mekoshei Sheitzim. I figure out exactly what the Mekoshei Sheitzim did. We'll see soon when we get up to Mahamer that there's a whole, it's very unclear from the Gemara, what, and from the Torah certainly, what the Mekoshei Sheitzim do. So in the context of that discussion, so the thing comes up, that maybe the Mekoshei Sheitzim Davka was trying to make a statement about Shmir Shabbos, that there's still an obligation of Shmir Shabbos in the Midbar, and therefore he Davka did this in order to get himself killed. So the Maharsha and the Kedushas Levi, or Levi Yitzchak and Berdichev, have very similar comments with a little bit of a twist, independently of each other. The Maharsha and Bava Basra says that this was a Malach Shenitzvichu L'Gufa, because his motivation was really separate from whatever question of what malacha was it, but whatever malacha it was, so his motivation was not to actually do the malacha, but it was to make the statement. So therefore, says Maharsha, it really should have been a malacha shenitzvichu l'gufa. So then the problem is, so then why was he executed? So this is something we touched upon a little bit last week. We talked upon the question of why it is to the machlokas in general, whether Yechayek or Pater. We mentioned that maybe it has to do, we mentioned the Tavos or Rebbe's suggestion, that maybe it has to do with the difficulty of Hasra. So the Maharsha in this context says that, yeah, his intent was Shemeshuth Lugufa, but the Edom had no way of knowing that. Right? They would look and you'd see somebody doing what looks to be an absolute malacha, so therefore he had the whole procedure, even though now that we know this clue, we can look back and say it was a malach shenitzvichu l'gufa. So, Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev in the Kedushas Levi in Parashat Shlach
So he has a very similar comment. He says that it seems like this is more constitutive of Gufa. The difference is, he said he doesn't know then why they executed him. So they both agree, the Marsha and the Kedushas Levi, that this was a Mokshin Shrukla Gufa, and the Kedushas Levi saying, therefore, it's the Shiloh why he was killed, and the Marsha saying he was killed because they had no way of knowing that that was the case. Hi.
Can you say it just arrived for Tosfos? Because Tosfos held that it's only, since he was still doing it based on Malacha, it doesn't matter what he was thinking.
Since he was still doing a Mishkan-based Malacha, right, well, that, you see, that all gets into this whole question, right, that even though, as is what Sandra was bringing up before, right, and this is actually how some have objected to this, so hold on a minute, we'll see how it relates to that objection, so hold on to the question for a second. So there were a number of Achronim. Hi.
Didn't they ask Hashem what to do with him?
So you're saying that Hashem should have said
there was no Malacha?
So that should have been Gilius. That's probably why the Kedushas Levi finds it to be still difficult. And according to the Marsha, I could say in the Hanami that the same way Misa's Bezdin never allows those factors to enter in, so even here, still the same story.
That means the first Jewish death penalty was an accident.
It was an intentional display. It was a purpose statement. It was an accident. It was essentially a ploy, even though it was a defendant.
Right,
we mentioned before, you need fancy lawyers to get yourself executed. It's not easy, so here you did it in an intervention. Yeah, that all of this is a kasha from the Gemara, before you get into this whole discussion, because this whole idea, the idea that he was doing it to make a statement is from Chazal. It's a difficult statement to properly appreciate, but that before you get into all these nuances, that question already comes from the Gemara. Hi.
Let's think
about
the Yeshua that later I saw. Chai for just tourists of the Honish. Mm-hmm. There's no way of ever telling on the Honish that you're Lachshin to Guva, that you would ever know.
So, saying, so therefore, he doesn't say that the rights of the Chai is can't. He says that you're part of that the Honish doesn't apply. So, you have the same problems for him as you have for anybody else. Whether you call it Asuman Torah, Pater, or Asuman Rabbanan a little bit, Asuman Rabbanan a lot, you have the same problem. All these issues of being able to figure it out, they're always going to be there.
Like, in their practice, you could never ever get off from Lachshin Shvut, that you would ever know why you're doing something.
If that's a problem, I think it's a problem for everybody. I don't know if it's more a problem for the Yeshua than anybody else.
So according to the Yeshua, the definition of Lachshin Shvut was a tour of Dach and Hodesh.
Still, but you still have, that just tells you what is left once it's not fired. But figuring out what you're fired now is going to be just as complicated for him as for anybody else. So there were those who objected to this whole mahal. More recently, for example, if you look at Rav Asher Weiss and say from Minchas Asher, so he expresses an objection, but he wasn't the first to express this. For example, Shuvas Karel David or David Greenwald, Simon Kuf, available on GreenwaldBooks.org. You can look it up. Karel David. So he expresses an objection to this whole story, he doesn't like it. Because he does assume that there's a distinction between purpose and motivation. So at the end of the day, somebody's got a gun to your head and says, cook. So you're cooking because you want to cook. Okay, the fact is somebody is forcing you to do it. But the malacha is still happening from the same perspective of the malacha. It's interesting, he rejects this whole line of thinking for that reason. But it's interesting just to consider the case that he was talking about. So, for example, in my Rick scenario, so you have, it's usually a pikuach nefesh situation anyway, so it has limited relevance, lamaisa. But in the case that Karel David was talking about, and there's also a discussion about this in the Shuvas Mekadshei Hashem. Shuvas Mekadshei Hashem is a collection of shuvas that were written from Rabbanim who went through the Holocaust. And there's a big commentary in the bottom called the Bidvar Tzvi. It's a rabbi from Chicago, Tzvi Hirsch Meisels. So he also went to the Holocaust and he printed all of these tshuvas from other rabbanim. It's called Tshuvas Mekadshei Hashem. And he has this commentary in the bottom. So he talks about the situation also. The situation was written before the war, say in Russia. So the scenario we mentioned, the Chofetz Chaim dealt with, somebody knows he's going to be conscripted into the army. And in the army, he's going to have to do all kinds of affairs. So he could take a job, let's say in some factory, and he knows that if he takes that job, they're not going to bring him into the army.
But if he chooses to take that job, that job's going to require him to be Mechal Shabbos. But maybe less than in the army. So maybe, even though right now he doesn't have a dochek to do this, but maybe he should take a job which will require him to be Mechal Shabbos now. It's a twist on the phrase that Gemara has, which is about Pikuach Nefesh, but here he's saying it's not necessarily Pikuach Nefesh. Chalel alav Shabbos Achas, Kedei Shishmeru Shabbos Harbe. And the Gemara says, you should mechal Shabbos and save someone's life so that he could be saved and observe many Shabboses in the future. So here his question was essentially working off that logic, but not applying it to Pikuach Nefesh. He'll have to mechal Shabbos much more in the army than he would in this job. So let him take this job and mechal Shabbos now less than he would in the army. So the Kerem Ledavid in general is not note that allow this. So if it was Pikuach Nefesh taking this job to save his life, so then he can do it. If he's taking his job, let's say, so that he'll have an easier life, so he says that doesn't justify the Chil Shabbos, nor was he convinced that it justifies that the preventing the future Chil Shabbos justifies the Chil Shabbos now, which gets into that whole sugya we touched upon with Bishol and Afia, that Hatei Kidei Shiyizke, can you sin now in order to prevent a bigger sin later, et cetera, et cetera. This is a whole discussion. So basically, his assumption here, it's interesting, this shaila, because it's a little bit different than the Pikuach Nefesh questions, which sometimes overwhelm the issue. So here, if he's taking this job, and so he's forced to be Mechal Shabbos, and his motivation is not that he doesn't die necessarily, but that he doesn't have to be Mechal Shabbos later, so if one accepts the Maharik's premise, so can one extend it to all these cases, and say that one should at least see that as a mlach shein shvichu l'gufa. Now, in the Hanami, if you accept the premise, then you'll say that if he's doing this, so he doesn't have to mechal Shabbos later, so all his later mechal Shabbos would also be a mlach shein shvichu l'gufa. So you might say, okay, so the Imam Shabbos. Either they're all not mlach shein shvichu l'gufa, or they all are mlach shein shvichu l'gufa. Either way, it just seems to shift the shaila. If you don't think that you could be Mechal Shabbos now in order to prevent the Mechal Shabbos later, so then you should take the same answer whether or not you think it's a Mechal Shabbos. So not necessarily, because perhaps if you're dealing with full-on Mechal Shabbos, so then we'll say, okay, you don't have the right to be Mechal Shabbos now, even to prevent Mechal Shabbos later. But once you're ready to call Mechal Shabbos, we say it's a Rabban. So maybe there is a cheshbon to say that could allow you to be Mechal Shabbos now, especially once you throw in all the other things that come along with the army, even if they are short of the Russian army we're talking about, even if they are short of actual Pikuach Nefesh. Assuming, again, you sign on to this logic, which those who discuss this, the Karev Adavid, and then the Chubbis Mechal Hashem, happen not to have signed on to this whole story, but if you did, maybe there is what to talk about. There also is a very interesting discussion in the Chuvus Igris Moshe. So the Moshe Feinstein, in his Chuvus in Arachayim and Chelek Aleph, has a discussion around Kufchav Gimel, I think, somewhere around there. So he has a discussion about this Myrin. And it's not clear the case that he's addressing. And the ambiguity leaves interesting room for speculation. But he starts off talking about the Ma'arik in the beginning of the Tshuva. And he raises the objections that have been raised by others that, again, distinguish between motivation and purpose. So they say, okay, so the motivation is coming from somebody with a gun to your head, but the purpose is still the same. So he goes through there, all the views we're showing here, or at least the two basic perspectives. And he says, either way, whether you hold from Tosfos, so you're doing it for the purposes of the Mishnah, or you hold from the other Rishonim, you're doing it, you're cooking for the purpose of cooking, you're cooking for the purpose of having the food. It just happens to be that your motivation comes from somebody with a gun to your head. So he initially raises that objection to the Maharik, but then in his second paragraph he warms up to it, and he says there is a difference between what the Maharik describes and, let's say, any other scenario where you do malach on behalf of somebody else. So if somebody else asks me to do malach and I do it for him, so maybe you should say, oh, okay, fine, so I'm not doing it for the purpose of Bishul, I'm doing it for the purpose of my friend. But that's not really compelling because your friend wants Bishul and you're helping him out. So okay, so then that becomes you're doing an act of Bishul. But when it's literally a case you have a gun to your head, So then your whole motivation is now you're not sharing in the person's goals at all. It's separate from the whole Stockholm syndrome consideration where a person identifies with his captors. In the normal circumstances, right, you're not identifying with these goals at all. You're just, your only interest is to remove the threat. So in such a case, he hears that difference, that maybe there is a distinction to be made between Stam, somebody having external motivations, where he could come to at least sympathize and share the goals of the other person, with a case where it's a threat to life, where your full motivation is really to prevent a negative, to get rid of this threat to your life that this person is posing.
Nine. So doctors are being included in that, or excluded?
Doctors in the which service? The doctors in...
We're working on residency.
Yes, so the whole purpose is not to get fired, the whole purpose is not to... possible. I don't know, he could have other treatments where he talks about this. I don't want to assume what Ramosha's view is about that, but here it possibly being applied. So he takes that view. I mentioned before the Chachma Shlomo about anybody who's paid is already maybe Moachshin Tzricha Legufa. So I mentioned that the Horus Nasan, the Nasan Gishtetner, doesn't accept it. So he again doesn't accept it for a similar reason to what Ramosha is expressing here in the non-Maharik situation. He's saying that essentially if somebody pays you, so he's paying you. But the fact is now you become his emissary. So now he wants it cooked, you want it cooked. He wants this ground plowed, so you want it plowed. And that's separate from the whole question, it's ancient of the Dvar Avera, or our whole opening discussion on the first day about Shlichus on Shabbos. Separate from that whole question, whether or not there is halachic Shlichus is not really the issue. The fact is, you are now his employee, you're interested in what he's interested in, so therefore he wants food cooked, he wants the field plowed, he wants these letters written, so you want all that, and that's all considered to be a malacha, it's reasonable. So what's fascinating, so then Reb Moshe, the last paragraph of this tshuva, to come back to him. So he makes that distinction, and he says that somebody's got a gun to your head, he can acknowledge that might be a malacha, it's reasonable. But Stam doing something on behalf of somebody else, that wouldn't necessarily be a malacha, it's reasonable. So in the last paragraph, and this is why it would be interesting to know exactly what situation he's addressing, which isn't clear from the tshuva. It says, so let's say a father asks a son to do something. So, kibbutz. So, does one have the right to say, okay, that's a malacha shemitzvah legufa, because he's interested not in the malacha, the father asks him to cook something. So he's not doing it for the sake of cooking, he's doing it because of the kibbutz of the father. So he doesn't buy that at all. He says that that's essentially the son wants to do what the father's telling him. That's the nature of the kibbutz. He has a number of reasons why he doesn't accept that svar. He doesn't consider that to be a malacha shen tzricha legufa at all. A little bit having to do with the nature of what the mitzvah of kibbutz is. A number of reasons why he's not sold on this idea. So what he leaves unsaid, and which is an interesting area for speculation, is you say kibbutz, but what kind of consideration is kibbutz here? So if the father is asking the son to do a malacha, so we know that normally that's not subject to kibbutz, but if the parent asks the child to do an aveiru, so kibbutz doesn't apply. So the key of mitzvah that comes from kibbutz is not going to really appear here as the motivation for the action. So the scenario that's perhaps more likely to come up is a situation, and those working at Yisrael and elsewhere, those kind of questions come up all the time. So what if somebody wants to do malacha because his parents making him do malacha? Not because they think I'll just keep it out that they're b'chuyuf to do it, and that changes the nature of malacha. That's not the issue. But the issue is, okay, let's say there's a tremendous tension in the household, whatever it is, that's being created by the parents wanting them to do malacha, they're not doing. So if the whole motivation is to be masalik the tension, not necessarily to identify with the goal, but to be masalic, the tension is causing a problem. I wonder whether Moshe would agree that maybe that's called malachshin shvich leguf. Again, he leaves that undiscussed. He assumes that the motivation of a child is to be mechaber the parent and to do what the parent wants because of the mitzvah. But it's an interesting question how it really applies on Shabbos when instruction to do a malacha by definition wouldn't be required under kibbutz, and therefore maybe the motivation is something else. Could that perhaps, not necessarily actually life and death, but could that be compared to some of the scenarios which he does acknowledge maybe on the other side of the divide?
So again, he doesn't discuss this. I think it's somewhat interesting ground for speculation. Okay, so a few more minutes. We won't get into too much about the specific malachos that are sometimes affected by this. I'll just throw out one or two of them, maybe mention one or two other points in the time we have left. There's one issue to be aware of. This comes up a lot in terms of dash, so we'll be up to dash relatively soon, God willing. So dash is the source of the issur of cholev, the issur of milking. So it's a whole question when a woman needs to nurse. So let's assume that child nursing, that's okay, that's normal derech achila. But what if a mother needs to nurse not directly into the child's mouth? So then that's a whole discussion. Sometimes it's done, let's say, either to make the child respond so the child should see what's going on, or even more commonly, nowadays, so there's such a thing as a pump. So setting aside the electric issues, whether the pump's electric or not electric, but the question of whether a woman using a pump is considered to be a malacha of cholev of dash, as is generally assumed. But what if she wants to pump not in order to feed the child, but let's say something is how it often comes up. Let's say the child is on some percentage of formula. So the mother is producing milk, but the child doesn't need all this milk. So then the problem is it's an issue of sar. It's tremendously uncomfortable for the woman. It's also an issue of continuing the process for future days. So therefore, there is a general attitude that removing the milk for that purpose is considered to be a malacha shein tzricha l'gufa. And that the makom tzar, this is the case I mentioned before, I didn't go into the details, it's not talking about a pump, but the Shulchan Aruch says that a nursing mother who doesn't have a child to actually nurse right now is able to remove the milk beyond, the Shulchan Aruch says, because of tzar. And that was where the Magen Avraham has this comment that's interpreted as saying that malacha shein tzricha l'gufa is mutter b'makom tzar. So maybe we'll get more into it in the Dutch discussion. So, well, the pump itself, let's assume that even if it's setting aside the electricity issue, but there's manual pumps and there are electric pumps. Setting aside the question of the electricity, so even though the Shulchan Aruch says biyad, so most posts can assume that it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't use a pump. What's a little bit more debated is the question is, so what happens to the milk afterwards? And it's the general premise here, and by the way, this is also a whole discussion in Eretz Yisrael, both now and historically, in terms of milking cows. We'll have deal on Shabbos, because there also, so even if we assume we can't take the milk for using milk, but it's also a Tzar Balei Chayim issue and it's other issues. So the question of how should the cows be treated, so this was a whole debate. It has an issue about them, you can read about it, it's in his biography, it's a contemporary issue as well. So if the assumption is that the milk is not going to be consumed, it's going to go to Ibu, so then the whole purpose is taking it out and not obtaining the milk, so then it seems that that makes it a malacha shein tzricha l'gufa. So the question is, how directly does it have to go to Ibu? So does it have to just go right out to the floor? There are those who maintain that even according to Rambam, that would be mutter, because that's a total makapra. That's really just going to taking the substance and letting it immediately go to waste. So there are those who feel that even the Rambam will allow that. And there are those who would require that. They assume that taking it in kli is going to create a new level of problem. Many posts, however, like the Avnei Nezer and others, assume that kli doesn't necessarily automatically make it l'gufa if the intent is to then right away split out. That even if one uses a kli in between, that the intent is to get rid of it, so then that's not necessarily going to turn it into a l'gufa question. And there's another consideration there that we'll get into in the dash discussion also, that it might just be that it has to do with the definition of dash. Maybe dash by its very nature is defined by taking it into some type of a holding pattern, taking it into something that's going to hold it, and letting something just come right out and not holding on to it, maybe it's not even dash to begin with. So there are two grounds that we make, though, both in terms of the definition of dash and the malachah shenitzricha leguf for consideration. So then that's a whole discussion with how the kli gets involved here, does the kli get in the way or not, and that's a little bit of a discussion. There are those who assume the kli is not necessarily radically redefined things, and others who are more concerned about it. There's a discussion about this in the Sefer Torah HaMalachos, where he mentions that the Ksos HaCholsha, it's just the Ksos HaShulchan, B'Vral HaChaim Noah, thought as a path through that discussion, that if one would express the milk into a kli, but only do it in very small amounts at once, and then one would also prevent there being a full shear, but that also becomes very difficult, barely any better than not using the kli, because the amount of progress is a very small amount to begin with. So that's one of the practical issues in which this comes up. There is also a discussion, if you look at the long put on the Shmir Shabbos Yehochus, where it talks about that somebody needs injections on Shabbos. It's also the same malacha. In terms of malacha of chogel, so usually injections are for the purpose either of pikuach nefesh or for the purposes of a chogel sheish bo sakana. So there's a lot of grounds you make anyway, but just in terms of preferences, so an injection that doesn't go into a vein is already preferable. It's not the potential of young blood. Once it does go into a vein, so then the question becomes, so why am I going into the vein? Am I injecting something into the blood? Or am I removing the blood? And that then enters into a large group of questions. If Chabal is usually about taking the blood out, and here you are poking into the vein, but not for the purposes of getting the blood out, so then that's more of a malacha shenitzricha legufa. Again, there's a discussion about this, but it is of limited relevance because it's just a question of preference usually rather than a question of asur or mutter. There is, I'll just mention, again, most of the other specific details, those is a very big discussion as far as how that plays out as far as the rules of shaving and haircutting and different scenarios, etc. So we will talk about that within its malacha. Just mention that there was, we accepted as a premise last week, that even though Dabar Sheinam Miskaven, which we'll get up to, God willing, very soon, one way or another, so that's really not a Shabbos concept per se. It has Shabbos details to it, but Dabar Sheinam Miskaven and Pesik Reisha is terminology that's really relevant to Kol Torah Kula in general. Malach Shein Esricha Legufa is, by its nature, really a Shabbos concept, where you have Malach HaShabbos. There is a discussion, this is a Ramah, which the Sefer Get Pashut comments on, Get Pashut commentary in Shulchan Aruch and Nezer. So he has the whole discussion that the Ramah seems to say, that even though there is a Nisr in the Torah of a tattoo, so if somebody tattoos his Eved, so that he can identify the Eved, then maybe the Eved is not going to run away, let's say, so then he's Pater. And the Get Pashut understands that in the sense of, it's a malacha shenitzricha legufa, that normally somebody would write on his skin because he wants the writing on the skin. And here you're writing so you're going to prevent the problem. So then maybe the same way we see that by malacha, there's a patur like that, so maybe you can extend that patur as well. And Chronin commented about that, and the Shubhas Laharvas Nasan is true about that also, that it's hard to believe that that's the case, and presumably malacha shenitzricha legufa is really a Shabbos concept, and not a concept that's really applicable to things outside a normal malacha, even if it's an action like kosev, which also happens to be a malacha, and here it's also kosev, but presumably we don't have a malacha shein shvich legufa p'tor. Okay, yes, sir.
I could even suggest that there's a p'tor from malacha shein shvich legufa and a p'tor from that malacha from Shabbos issue.
That's what he's objecting. It's unlikely that it really is one. So just there is a discussion about it. Why exactly is Ramah says Pater still somewhat of an undefined territory? Just throwing that into the mix. All right, let's try to recap what we spoke about. So we spoke about so far that there is, first of all, the question of what is the definition, which view in Rishonim wins out, the view of Tosfos to the view of the other Rishonim. Is it a Mishkanian definition like Tosfos, or is it more of a positive-negative distinction like all the others? And we mentioned that the Magen Avraham, as well as the 39 Melachos book, takes the Mishkeni and Tosfos view, and the Taz seems to take the other view. And we mentioned in the Nesivos Shabbos, it says one should be machmir for both, which presumably means it has to fit both definitions. And we just threw out a question in terms of that issue of being machmir for both, that maybe there's a whole other hakira one could be asking here, that what is it that the Melacha Hatzrich Lagufa defines the Melacha, or She'ena Tzrich Lagufa is an exemption, and therefore that may affect the question of whether it has to be only one thing or could be more than one thing, and that may affect the whole issue in general. And then we talked about the question of how do we paskin? Do we paskin like Rabbi Yehuda? Do we paskin like Rabbi Shimon? So the Rambam and the Riff paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, and the Shulchan Aruch is often associated with Rabbi Shimon, even though it's a discussion. In a couple places he brings both views. Some understand that to mean he's not machria. Others understand it to mean he is machria, and that's a standard presentation format that he'll say what he thinks first, and then Derech Eretz mentioned the other view. And we mentioned the third step, the same method of Shulchan Aruch, where he paskins that one can be chayiv for cutting nails, that provokes some controversy, because Tosfos says that's only according to Yehuda. So the Gra and the Yerlacha says maybe that shows the Shulchan Aruch paskins like indeed like the Yehuda, but there's a way out of it by simply understanding that whole sugi differently, and that's as many assume, and the Pri Chodesh and others see this as a, see the case to be that passing auction to the Lugufa, everyone against the Rambam, etc. And then we talked about what does that mean to say auction to the Lugufa is putter. So does that mean it's a straight Rabbanan? So it's not so simple that the Pnei Yeshua actually thought it was a lav and a Torah without an omesh. It's not the generally accepted view, but still there are those who assume that it's more machmir than a normal Rabbanan. We mentioned a couple different ways to see that, either because you think that it's actually Mr. Raisa, or maybe because you're choshesh to the view of the Rambam, acknowledge that there's a major view in Rishonim that it's chayiv, or that you call it the Rabbanan, and it's a Rabbanan that's conceptually very similar to the Raisa, or like the Ran seems to express, that it's a Rabbanan which is just practically too similar to the Raisa, and therefore very dangerous. And in the context of the Ran, he says that Makom Seid and Amir Malakum are not mutter here because of that Chumrah. Then we discussed the Magen Avraham's view, which is taken to be by later Svarim, Nachas HaShakel among them, having such a discussion, that Melach HaShemshich Lagufa is Mutter B'Makom Sar. And we discussed also Shlomo Zalman's Tshuva, where he's basically Machmir, in the case of Bein HaShemashos, saying there's no Heter for Bein HaShemashos, even though it should be viewed as a Drabarim. And then we talked about Dvar Yeshua's more lenient Tshuvas, where he says that Kavod HaBrios would be doch a Melach HaShemshich Lagufa, and that whatever leniency is seen in the context of Hetiru Sofim Shem Chilasan would also apply. Him talking in that scenario about somebody turning off his engine in his car once he's driven somebody to the hospital, which you assume was a Melach HaShemshich Lagufa. And then we talked about the whole other level, the question of, is there another Madrega here of not just purpose, but motivation? Does motivation make something a Melach HaShemshich Lagufa? So I mentioned the Maharik commenting on the Gemara at the end of the Yevamos that if somebody has a gun to his head and does Malacha for that reason, so it's Malacha Shein Tzrich Lagufa. We saw that the Chafetz Chaim accepted this in terms of the soldiers in the Russian army, that what they're forced to do is Malacha Shein Tzrich Lagufa. And we mentioned also that some posts can say that a resident who has forced to do more Malachas than are otherwise justifiable by Pekuach Nefesh might also be able to see that as Malacha Shein Tzrich Lagufa. It's the Chachma Shlomo, who says that any worker who's being paid can point to that as motivation to make it Tzrich Lagufa. The Laharus Nafsan and presumably many others disagreed. And then we talked about the question of Vaisha Shavas, if somebody is unsure about his Jewish status, does doing a Malacha help in that case? Should that be viewed as a Malacha Shein Tzrich Lagufa? And then we mentioned Dani's story that Rebecca Kamenetsky says that should be Somech and the Rambam for that, but we also mentioned that perhaps for purposes of making a statement that you're not Shomer Shabbos, maybe it's enough. And in that context, you mentioned that many of these positions are influenced by the Maharsha and the Kedushas Levi, who both say that the Mekoshe Sheisim, according to the opinion of the Gemara, that he was trying to make a statement, is really a Malach HaShemashvich Lagufa, and just the variation is that the Maharsha says he was executed anyway because they even couldn't know, and the Kedushas Levi says he doesn't understand why he was executed. He thinks that's basically a Kashim. And you mentioned that some
Chas Asher informed the Karen Ladavid, objected to this whole approach, basically distinguishing between purpose and motivation. The Karen Ladavid's case, an interesting case, we talked about the question of whether somebody can accept a job to keep himself away from future problems of Chilul Shabbos and the like, if that job now will involve him doing malachos. We call that a malach shenshirich l'gufa. The Karen Ladavid himself rejecting that. And we mentioned that Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he considers the Maharik and raises the objection that it would seem like you should distinguish between motivation and purpose, but in the end defends the Maharik and says the difference between having a gun to your head and doing something for someone else, a gun to your head, really your whole motivation was to solve the problem, and that could be walking Shrif Lagufa, Ain't Shrif Lagufa, and then he says he's not willing to extend that to somebody acting on behalf of his father to say that the Kibbutz is a separate type of motivation. But then we raise the question, what if it's not because of Kibbutz, but if it's because of whatever tension is being created by the conflict, and maybe that does create the grounds, and that was an open question that we're not sure how to address. And then we just discussed a little bit some of the cases where this question comes up, the question of a nursing mother expressing milk not in the context of giving it to the baby. So that's a dush problem, but when it's done just to relieve the pain of the mother or for some other purposes the post can talk about, potentially could be a malach shenitzriku l'gufa and might be mutter b'malach tzar. And we discussed also, this comes up in the context of injections. Injections are also potentially a chavala issue, but there's room to distinguish between when you want to get the blood out and when you want to put something into the blood. And again, those distinctions usually only being relevant for preferences because it's usually a chalish yesh bo sakana or pikuach nefesh straight out issue. Now, we just mentioned the question of whether there's any tzad to say this exists by other yisurim as well, the question by tattoos. When the Ramah Paters by the Eved Gideshul Yivrach, is that an example of the Get Pashut said of Malach Shemishrik Gufa, and the general consensus that it's hard to apply that to other cases. Okay, so tomorrow our agenda is, we have one more day of the Lumdas. We'll talk about tomorrow. I want to talk specifically tomorrow about Toldos Shemishrik Gufa, the question of how this whole concept applies to that, maybe some other loose ends on the sugya that we'll wrap up, God willing, tomorrow. And then we'll have to decide either Wednesday we'll start Segresha, or we'll do toast with Silmer and Sarah Bates and pick up Segresha fresh from next year. Should have a wonderful day. Good things. How are you?